Thank you. 30 years ago, one of the highest-profile terrorist attacks of the IRA's campaign shocked the nation. The victim was Lord Mountbatten. He was a supreme Allied commander in Southeast Asia in World War II, the last Viceroy of India, and great-uncle and mentor to Prince Charles. He was killed at the helm of his fishing boat soon after setting out on a family trip. A bomb had been hidden on board, exploding just minutes after they left the harbour. Three people actually died. 79-year-old Lord Mountbatten, his 14-year-old grandson Nick, and 15-year-old Paul Maxwell, who helped on the boat. The other passengers who were all caught up in the blast and seriously injured were Nick's twin brother Timothy, their parents, and their paternal grandmother, who died the next day. It was a terrible, terrible atrocity. For many years, Tim was unable to come to terms with the tragedy and the loss of his twin. He has now written a book about it called From a Clear Blue Sky, Surviving the Mountbatten Bomb, and he joins us this afternoon. Tim Natchbull, good afternoon to you.
Hello.
So, you and Nick, let's just talk about your family first of all. You and Nick were the youngest of seven children and identical to the point that few could tell you apart.
That's true. There was one tiny but telltale sign, which is under my left chin, there's a mole. And so if there was doubt about which twin was being spoken to, a relative would lift our chin, have a look, and if there was a mole there, they knew it was me.
And looking in the book, there are pictures of you from before your brother died, and yes, it's impossible to tell.
And it was great fun being a twin, and my parents brought us up really symmetrically, very identically. We dressed the same, and we were christened. Nicholas was Nicholas Timothy, and I'm Timothy Nicholas. And it was really that sense of fun. It felt like being in a two-boy club all of our own. And my parents thought, they had five children, they thought, well, we'll just go for one more. And then about 3 weeks before we were born, my mother was told, I think there's two in there. So they ended up with seven. And my elder brothers and sisters were fantastic influence on us growing up, and those are my predominant memories of childhood, really a fun, happy, very close-knit family.
And I read that you only spent a couple of days apart from each other.
Yes, I think it was a handful in a lifetime of 14 years, nearly 15. I remember one time going back to boarding school, and it was my second term, and shortly before we went, Nicky got German measles, so he stayed back. And then he wrote to me that day, he wrote to me the next day. So each day I was separated from, I had a letter. And those two letters are the only two letters I ever received from him. And I kept them at the time for no apparent reason. And I treasure them now, they're fond reminders. But really, in nearly 15 years, I would say just a handful, 4 or 5 days, were ever spent apart. We were just intensely close.
So that's your immediate family. How does Lord Mountbatten fit into the family tree?
Well, he was the senior figure in the family. He's my mother's father. He had two daughters, my aunt, Pamela Hicks, and my mother, Patricia Braben. And we grew up with him really at the centre of our family. I was born shortly, a few years, 4 years after his wife Edwina died in 1960. And he was coming up to his retirement, 1965. He really made sure that his home in Hampshire and his holiday home in the west coast of Ireland were always full of children and grandchildren and the family. And he was a terrifically fun, helpful and involved grandfather. He had this wonderful streak about him. Someone said famously of Churchill that he was a world figure, but with Boy Scout enthusiasm. The same went for my grandfather, and for us kids, it was just terrific fun for him to be interested in what we were doing and interested in our toys. And he wasn't childish, but he was childlike, and therefore we really bonded with him.
And anyone, I guess, over 40 will remember, or even 35, will remember your grandfather as quite a big figure in our national life. He was sort of Prince Charles's mentor. He'd had a war record. He was amazingly respected. He would be at the moments where the state showed itself, wouldn't he? He was famous isn't the right word, but he was the establishment personified.
Well, I think he had this incredible drive all through his life, and of course it took him in the Second World War. He started the war as a destroyer captain. In fact, he was docked in Londonderry for repairs when he first went down and saw this house that his wife had inherited in the west coast of Ireland, and he was overcome by the beauty of it. But rapidly he was promoted, and he ended the war as a Supreme Allied Commander. So that gave him an international visibility in the world, and shortly afterwards, 1947, he went out to India for the transfer of power, and that was a momentous moment, I think, for the British psyche. It was a risky appointment for him, but he and my grandmother were deemed to have done a fantastic job, and I think that did give him a visibility in this country and internationally, which, as he went on, became First Sea Lord, later Chief of the Defence Staff, he stayed, I think, in the seams, in the public consciousness, in a way which really was very warm. I remember him taking us to the Royal Tournament to take the salute, and we were amazed as young kids, sort of 5-6 years old, that Grandpapa would stand up, a spotlight would be trained on him, and thousands and thousands of people round would rise to their feet and cheer and clap as if he was a family member or something. It was a lesson to us, just what he meant to other people.
The day that changed your life was the August Bank Holiday 1979. Do you remember much about getting ready to go on the boat and leaving the harbour?
I do. It was a beautiful day, clear blue sky. We'd had a happy family breakfast. My grandfather had come down wearing his favourite T-shirt given to him by the survivors of HMS Kelly, of which he'd been the captain, part of a destroyer flotilla called the Fifth Flotilla, or the Fighting Fifth. And he came down wearing this T-shirt saying, "The Fighting Fifth." And as I pushed past him to get some breakfast, he was coming out. He bent down, he lifted my chin. "There's the mole. Up, morning to me." "Morning, Fighting Fifth," I said. And it wasn't much later that morning that we left, went down into the harbour, and carefully helped him down the steps. He was 79 years old. It was a vertical ladder that he had to go down because the tide was low. And my 83-year-old grandmother, who I adored as well, a wonderful lady called Doreen Braben, and we got them on board, and my twin brother and I went on. My grandfather wanted a photograph taken of the boat that day, so my father stayed on the quay, took a photograph, and then joined us, and my mother sat in the stern, my grandmother, and as we moved along, it was a flat, calm sea, a really wonderful, beautiful day. Everybody who had a boat was out on the water in the village. There were many boats, probably dozens of boats, and we nodded and waved at people, and we were on our way to pick up lobster pots. We'd gone maybe 3/4 of a mile or so, and my grandmother, sitting with her feet up in the back of the boat catching the sun, turned to my mother, who was reading a backdated copy, I think, of the New Statesman, and said, "Isn't this a beautiful day?" And I don't have a clear memory of what happened next. There was this incredible explosion, and I have just a snatched recollection of this very forceful, violent sensation, and then of being lying in the bottom of a boat, lying on some hard wooden boards of what I knew was a very small boat. I could hear the sound of an outboard engine very close by, and I could feel its vibration, and I could hear these two voices very close to me, two people, Irish accent, very kindly but very worried, emotionally charged, saying, trying to reassure me. And that was my first recollection. I'm told I had no sight. I had lost, well, I was peppered from the explosion quite badly, injured, and I knew that I just had to concentrate very, very hard trying to work out what was wrong with me. And it wasn't long before they got me to the harbour. I couldn't work out what was wrong with me. The only thing I could really work out was that I was cold, desperately, desperately cold, the sort of cold I'd never really felt before or after. And when I told them that, they tried to cover me up, just had one towel on their little boat, and they got me to the harbour. And by that time, other boats had picked up, other members of my family, and the body of Paul Maxwell, this lovely Irish boy who was spending his holiday really earning pocket money looking after this boat, but it felt like he was on holiday with us. And they got us to the harbour, where the local people were tremendously kind and helpful, and ran around and grabbed a broom and broke it, and to act as a splint here and carry there, and ambulance came, and we got to the hospital in Sligo, and were met by, again, a wall of loving support and brilliant care. And Jeremy, really, that was critical, because it meant for me, my experience of Ireland, 14 years of going there, had all been about friendliness and hospitality and wonderful people, wonderful place. And really that continued from the moment after the explosion. I received nothing but the most wonderful care and attention. And that meant that when we did come back to England, I was in intensive care for 3 days. Opposite me in intensive care was a bed, a curtain drawn round it. I didn't know who was in it, but I could hear the doctors talking to somebody. I imagined it was a very young girl, and from the way they were talking, she was obviously utterly helpless, and they were talking to her, "We're just going to move your hands now. We're just going to move your arm. You're okay, Patricia. Now, it never occurred to me this Patricia was my mother, and she was hovering on the edge of death for days, connected to a machine that breathed for her, 117 stitches in her face, 20 in each eyeball. And she did, she lived, and became a mainstay of my life in future. To my right, my 83-year-old grandmother, at 9 o'clock the next morning, Tuesday morning, she died in the bed next door to mine. My father, there was no other bed available in intensive care, so he was in the next door ward. But we were reunited, and we went on, and when we got back to England a few weeks later, huge mailbag came from Ireland, and indeed other countries, as well as from around England and the rest of the UK. And there were wonderful letters of love and support from old and young and from all sorts of people. And one really shook me, really, really went right to my core. I remember the moment I opened it and unfolded it and looked at it and read it, and I withdrew into my parents' home in London. I withdrew into a back room and read it again. It came from the coroner in Sligo. This is a few months later, January 1980, and it said, "I recognise that you, in the loss of your twin brother Nicholas, you've had something awful, but I..." He went on for a little bit on a few other points. He finished his letter, "I hope the day will come when we have peace again in this country, and this beautiful place which was put here for everybody to enjoy is a place where you will be able to come back again and enjoy." And I wanted that so much, and eventually I was able to do that, and that's what's caused me to make this journey and write this book.
Mm. Just to go back to your brother's death, because of course you didn't know, and your father, as you say in your book, didn't want to be the first to tell you, so it fell to your sister. Now, what happened?
Well, it was, I can imagine, a heavy burden for her. I'd been in the hospital for 3 days. My father was terribly caring and thoughtful, and he'd thought this through and had said, "Why don't you go in to see Tim and take your aunt," this is my aunt, Pamela Hicks, "take Aunt Pammy with you." And this is what my sister did. And she sat down, and I was always loved it when I had family visiting in the hospital, so I was delighted to see my sister, and very close to both my sisters. She sat down and she looked at me, and I could tell from the expression in her face that she had something serious to say. Now, I'd asked about my family members, those I couldn't see beforehand. Where's Grandpapa? Where's Granny? And where's Nicky? Now, on good medical advice, I was so sedated, I was so injured and so weak, the advice of the doctors, who, when I had arrived in the hospital, were not sure that I would live, had been, "Don't tell him too much too quickly." And so I hadn't been told he was dead. When my sister told me, I just looked into her eyes. There was a moment, and then as she dissolved into tears, I followed her, and it was the moment that I realized my life had changed forever.
And you'd never lose the pain of that?
Well, I think I recognised that everybody in the family was hurting, and everybody was carrying on, and I needed to do the same. I buried my face later when my family left. I hid under the sheets. I didn't want to appear weak. I didn't want to upset as well these wonderful, kindly nurses who were moving around, and I buried my face and just cried quietly. But later I fell asleep and I woke up. I knew I just had to carry on, and I knew I wanted to give a signal to other people that I was okay. I could imagine what it felt like for my parents. Not really, Jeremy, like you now, the father of young children. It wasn't until I was a father myself I could quite comprehend what that meant to my parents, to lose one of their youngest children. But I wanted to reassure them I was all right, in order to lessen their pain, their worry, and allow them hopefully to move on. And that's what my family was so good at, and I followed the example of my brothers and my sisters and my parents, and that got me through those first painful, difficult weeks and months.
There's so much more to talk about, and honestly, we could go on for another hour on this. The state funeral for Lord Mountbatten, which was part of our lives as well, because we were all watching it. And then, of course, the perpetrators, and then you find out how they did it and how precise they were, and your feelings for them, particularly in the light of the peace process that's followed.
But of course, the peace process is just so important, so wonderful. Personally, I went back to Ireland in 2003. I was a father, very happily married in 1998. And in this wonderful, warm, loving relationship I was in, I felt secure enough emotionally to go back to Ireland to address those issues that you've mentioned of how the attack had been carried out and by whom and why and how. And I needed answers, Jeremy, and there was precious little information for me to tap into when I started asking these questions, which really was 2003, and I decided that I would just go to the west of Ireland very quietly and peacefully and privately and spend time there, a week at a time, each month, for a period of a year. And in talking with the people in our local community, Mullaghmore, the west coast of Ireland, County Sligo, I came to a whole new level of understanding. And with that came really this sense of peace, this sense of saying goodbye to my darling twin, Nicky, but also gaining a new sense of forgiveness and a new understanding, and indeed a whole new appetite for life, an energy level, a happiness that's come into my life. And I have five children now, and I'm having a really happy time, and hopefully I'm a better father, a better husband, a better friend and colleague as a result of having laid a lot of these memories to rest.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about that terrible day and the years since. Tim Nachbull, who's written From a Clear Blue Sky, story about the bomb that killed not just Lord Mountbatten, but also his twin brother, Nicky.